Ce podcast est une production Blabla Studio.
Track Record, c'est le podcast qui donne la parole aux DJ. Vous entendez leur son partout, nous vous proposons ici d'écouter leur voix. Je suis Pauline de Saint-Sauveur. Après 10 ans passés en communication pour des grandes marques, je deviens rédactrice freelance, d'abord sur des sujets mode et beauté, puis je m'attaque à mon autre passion, la musique électronique. Track Record est né de cette envie, partager avec vous la découverte de personnalités tout aussi passionnantes que leur musique. Alors j'espère que vous aurez envie de monter le son et d'appuyer sur Play. Bonne écoute!
Welcome to Track Record, the podcast that gives the floor to the DJs. I am Pauline de Saint-Sauveur, and today I am meeting with the German DJ and producer Patrice Bommel. Welcome, Patrice.
Thank you for having me, Pauline.
Thank you for being with us for this 11th episode of Track Record and the third one in English. Thank you also for making the time to talk to us just a few hours away from your only gig in France for a while. Tonight you will be at the Silencio together with Edouard, Street Machine, Bakean and Moon for a belly pop party that promises to be one of a kind since it will be your first time playing at this Parisian venue. But first, let me introduce you to the ones who only know you by name. You started your career as a DJ 20 years ago by winning a Red Bull competition in Sao Paulo. Today, you are one of the most respected figures in the industry, for you manage to be as prolific on stage as in the studio. You keep on delivering both strong and poetic sets from your hometown Amsterdam, where you were a long-time resident at the iconic Trouw and Club 11, to the Panorama Bar in Bergen, Berlin, also in festivals such as Fusion, Tomorrowland, or Burning Man, to name just a few. And more unexpectedly, at the Ushuaia Ibiza, where I had the chance to meet you this summer. From your first album, Vapor, back in 2010, you never cease to receive acclaim from your peers, as well as from your faithful audience, who follow you through your various releases, namely 18 singles and EPs of your own, on the most prestigious labels, notably Roar on Get Physical in 2008, Speicher 81 and Speicher 85 respectively in 2014 and 2015 on Compact, Norse in 2016 on Correspondent, one of my favorites personally, and the iconic Lutus on Afterlife in 2017. That same year, you were nominated at the DJ Awards in the Deep House category. The reason for your longtime success might be that you have the utmost capacity to work with everyone, from Stephen Baldwin to Kamal Fat, from Monolink to Adana Twins, to adapt to every setting and audience while keeping your musical signature that calmly flows from your decks as well as from the many edits and remixes you produced over the years. I think you are up to more than 100 now. You also have a talent for curation. Your Balance Presents compilation released in 2016 was a success, as well as your mix for the BBC in 2021, which ended up in the shortlist for Essential Mix of the Year. And last but not least, one can perceive in your music, as well as in your poised attitude towards the industry, an urge for balance, a search for happiness, and a call for honesty that make you committed in every aspect of your art and of your life. Thanks to your new Hello project that I hope you will talk us through, you aim at drawing your own definition of a party based on unity, adventure, and kindness. That is exactly what we perceive when you play, a holistic musical approach in which you take us by the hand through a small labyrinthine path where shadows are smartly approached, but always to be trimmed by light in the end and by the search of a greater connection between us and the intangible. To sum it up, I would say you are a kind of techno shaman which forcefully follow into all kinds of colorful musical travels, and I hope these 40 minutes with you will be one more adventure. Is that introduction okay with you?
Yes.
Great. So to get back to here and now for a second, I know you have a special relationship with our country. You played in Paris many times, notably at the Rex. You speak pretty good French and you worked with the composer Sylvain Chauveau on your latest release, Zero Gravity. So how does it feel to be back in Paris and to play at Silencio for the first time tonight?
For me, going to Paris is always, it's always a treat. First of all, I love that it's so close to Amsterdam, so the journey isn't too tiring. What I love most about the city is just how filled it is with beautiful buildings, and it's just oozing history. And every time I walk through Paris, I try to imagine myself what the city would have looked like through the eyes of someone in the 19th century, because this was the center of the world. And if you come from some small village and you've never seen anything but, you know, the little local church, and then you come to Paris, it must have been just as overwhelming as going to Manhattan today. And funny enough, Paris, it wasn't love at first sight.
Really?
It took me a few visits to really get the city. And now I love it more and more. Every time I come back, I love it more. Also, Paris already feels like the South, where, for instance, Amsterdam, where I spent most of my life, is still distinctly a northern city. Here you can already, I mean, the weather's warmer. It always is a few degrees warmer. It's a little bit balmier. The life takes place more on the streets. I also love the colonial influence. It's just so multicultural. It's just, you know, especially so many Western African influences that we don't really have in Holland, or also not in less so in Portugal, where I live now. So yes, in terms of playing, I think my way of playing really fits well with the city. I think the Paris techno scene has kind of been educated most notably by Laurent Gonyer.
Yes.
And
Alex as well.
And to me, Laurent is definitely one of the DJs that have had the most influence on how I curate a night, how I tell a story on the dance floor, because he's the master storyteller.
Okay, so yeah, you have a particular link. Also, you play the tracks. So yes. It's like...
Yes.
But it's a complete different venue tonight. It's much more theatrical,
mm-hmm.
and much smaller. So you're kind of excited to play there as well, like to challenge a new format.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm super curious about Silencio.
And are you going to play your Halo concept or just a normal one?
I'll just play a normal party. Even if I'm doing a Halo night, which means I would play from beginning to end all night long.
Also, okay, that includes an all-nighter. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I never really have a plan what I'm playing beforehand, but I really adapt to the situation and then improvise in the moment.
So we'll see tonight.
Yes.
And we're looking forward to hearing you there. To then get back to Reverb, like long time ago, I would like to go back to your roots as a musician, because you grew up in Dresden in
yes.
Eastern Germany when the wall was still up. And you had a father who was music journalist,
yes.
in jazz to be exact. And we'll say hello to Jeppe, from whom I told, like, you have common father's passions. And you had also this difficult context on the one part, but a music I'm bringing on the other part. So how do you think that duality planted the seeds of the artist you grew into being now?
From a music perspective, I think being exposed to music from a really early age and then almost all day long, every day, I really trained my ear, and it really helps me to translate emotions into music, but also to translate music into emotion, because you need both to close the circle between you and the crowd. So even though I've never learned to play an instrument, I have no formal musical education. I'm completely self-taught, and I'm kind of, you know, in the studio, everything is trial and error. I do it by ear. I cannot read notes or anything. But I think that upbringing has given me, it was the best gift my father could give me. And it really prepared me for the kind of work that I'm doing today. From a political perspective, growing up in a communist country, what I love about it is that I have an inside and an outside view at today's capitalistic society.
Yes, of course.
So I see things that other people don't see. For instance, I'm more sensitive to the way people are programmed in this society to think in a certain way, because the propaganda in the Western society is distinctly different from the propaganda in a communist country. At the same time, also, I mean, it fills me with a lot of gratitude not being stuck behind communist walls and spending my life without much opportunity to travel. So the wall coming down when I was 14 years old was a godsend for me, because the world opened up, and other than, for instance, my grandparents, they never really got to travel until they were beyond 65. And then they're, you know, in East Germany, old people were, of course, allowed to travel because nobody needs them anymore. And if they leave, then that's just one less a pension to pay. So they don't really care about old people, but anyone at working age or younger could not travel even to West Germany.
I was requested to stay.
Yes.
And that's why, in paradoxically, I was maybe thinking that a thrive for traveling was also because you grew up also in a, I mean, until you were 14, but your childhood was spent in a way that you were not likely to travel.
That's certainly...
And like now you like traveling the world all the time.
Yes, so. Yes. That was, especially initially, there was a huge hunger and curiosity for the world. Now it's, of course, it's a little different. I've been around the world several times over. I think I've seen close to 100 countries. And all of a sudden, the thought of spending time at home and not having to travel sounds really attractive as well.
Yes, but now it's not in a, I mean, you're not forced. It's like kind of a free will. So it's much better.
Yes.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And as an Eastern European, how do you judge the situation in the East today? If you may respond, because East happened, I mean, so much stuff is happening.
You mean like the Ukraine situation?
Yes, Ukraine situation, because I guess from your upbringing, you also have a different eye on that than we have, I guess.
I think it's a situation that is far more complex than people think. And my heart really goes out to my Russian and also, of course, my Ukrainian friends, especially my Ukrainian friends, many of whom have lost their homes. They are now living abroad. And it pains me to witness that something this useless, because at the end of the day, this war isn't about democracy and freedom. It's just about the fight for the global hegemony and
resources.
It's about natural resources, and it's the fight for the Americans to try to keep the dollar as the world reserve currency, because what they don't like is when another country, and in this case the Russians, starts to sell their oil and gas in their own currency and not use the dollar anymore. Because the moment other countries don't use the dollar or are not forced to use the dollar to buy and sell their oil, the Americans kind of lose the privilege of just printing money out of thin air and buying natural resources with it. The moment America loses the world reserve currency, all of a sudden they have to actually do something.
They lose power. Yeah.
They lose power. They have to actually be productive in order to earn their resources and buy stuff from other countries. So this whole war, I think, also signifies a change of guard. I think the West is on its way down, unfortunately. And when I look at the European Union and I see how mismanagement is the norm, and you think that governments here are incompetent the way they handle the natural resource issue with Russia. But I actually am of the opinion you cannot be this incompetent, because these people are smart. I think that you could almost suspect that our European governments are compromised in some way and are working against their own people. And that worries me. And looking forward into the future, I think this conflict will have grave economic consequences for us here in Western Europe. So,
and if we don't know how to turn east in a smart way, I mean, because we don't, we're still on our Western boundaries
Yes, we have to accept that the world changes, that other countries are coming up, that, for instance, countries like China, India, the Arabic world, they've caught up, and they no longer want to be told by anyone else what to do, how to live their lives.
They're not colonies anymore.
Yeah, exactly. They don't want they don't want to be colonized
economically either.
Yes. And I can absolutely sympathize with wanting to be free and self-governed. I hope that this conflict doesn't escalate into something even worse, say a nuclear conflict that could wipe us all out over just greed and stupidity and ego, but that we find the path forward into what will be a multipolar world where more than just one country is going to determine how things are being run.
I agree. I completely agree. For our first question, that was a huge one. I will try to go to the second question then, because I think in difficult times, especially, we have also in the UK very difficult times right now. And I think music also helps to put people together and to have a common thinking that was a bit out of the box, especially in the UK, they're kind of leaders on that. And there is one band that you really love who was kind of forward thinking on this with Depeche Mode. And I would like to know why also there are a main reference that you quote and why their work is so important to you.
I think what always fascinated me about electronic music, and I think Depeche Mode was the gateway into electronic music, was the the juxtaposition of machine sounds and the human element, the human warmth. And I think if you listen to Depeche Mode's records, they always had a very technological backdrop. The sounds of synthesizers, yes, and samples and sampled metallic sounds going on in the background. And then Dave Gahan's and Martin Gore's warm voices, that infusion of emotion. Yeah, that is basically what, to this day, is what I'm seeking in my music, musical philosophy. I always try to combine the monotonous, the machine-like, with the emotion and the warmth, and to create these interesting contrasts to go from one to the other extreme.
That's pretty much what I perceived in your latest release with Sylvain Chauveau. There was really, to me, there were accents of Depeche Mode, but like from the early ages.
Yes.
With this contrast that you're describing in Zero Gravity. So that was what you were aiming at doing, or was that wrong?
I think subconsciously, yes. Sylvain's voice really, yes, also reminds me a little bit of Dave Gahan. Even though he has his own touch, what I also really love about his voice is that it's beautiful English with a slight French accent. I discovered him through, he remade a song by Lickley, I Follow Rivers, and his version blew me away. So I went into his whole catalog, and it's just, he's a very interesting musician.
And he's also an artist, a bit like the Depeche Mode members were. They were like more like sometimes artists painting, and his Sylvain is also someone who is not only a composer.
He's a smart, thoughtful person with many curiosities, and it was really a pleasure recording with him, yes.
So that was also a bit of, for you, an artistic project as well as a like music project.
Yeah, it's just something that I wanted to do. Just also, I've remixed before with voices, but for instance, I've never written lyrics. So that was a huge...
you wrote... Okay.
Yes, yeah, so...
I was not aware. Congrats.
No. So I wrote the lyrics for the song, and that was just a huge challenge. I've never done that before. And he sang them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because okay, as he was a composer, I was like, okay, he wrote and Patrice made the music, and okay, I'm going to re-listen to it.
Yeah, in this case, he was just the voice. Yeah.
That was beautiful, actually.
I used him like an instrument almost, yes.
No, it's funny that really it reminded me of your whole, like, you know, Depeche Mode universe. So maybe as you wrote, you got back to your roots as well. And that's what really inspired you in the beginning. Yes. I'm really going to re-listen to this one. And actually, if we come back to the beginning of your career, you started in 2003 as a DJ.
I started earlier.
Earlier, yeah, in Amsterdam,
like,
right?
Not even in East Germany. When I was like 17, I started first, like many, as a bedroom DJ. Started buying tons of records. And after school, straight to the bedroom, behind the decks, played all night, smoking joints, had friends around, you know. I only had one deck. And a friend of mine had another deck, so we put them together, and then we both kept on practicing. And many years I was just like a local DJ, a local, you call it a local hero. And interestingly enough, that was also the hardest and most competitive time of my career, because at that level, it's really, good gigs are scarce, and there's many up-and-coming DJs who are competing, and there's a lot of backstabbing going on, so... Nowadays, the atmosphere between colleagues is totally different. We're all really, you know, we are...
Peaceful.
We're peaceful, we're social, we're happy for each other's successes. We are, you know, we share music. It's really, the atmosphere is one of a big family.
Yeah, like you do back-to-backs and stuff.
So exactly,
it's different.
Yes.
You more melt your universes than you oppose.
Yeah, and it's because when you operate at a professional level, it's much easier to be generous, because there isn't much scarcity. We all make enough money to put food on the table and to not worry about the small aspects of life. So, these early years, I think they were really important to just, you know, to play all night in a bar for 50 euros and play to people who don't even want to listen to your music. So you have to, every night you have to adapt. Okay, what kind of crowd is that today? Okay, there's a lot of 50, 60 year olds. Let's go back in time, play some more disco. But that really taught me to to read the dance floor. And also it gives me an appreciation for the things that are coming my way today, because, you know, it's so easy to take it for granted and then to lose your roots, to fall for the illusion that you're something special. No, you're just another person.
But were there actually, as we talk about people, were the special people that pushed you to say, okay, but this is your calling, you have to be a DJ, you should do more. For you, it should not be just a hobby. Were the special people that kind of pushed you from that phase that you were talking about, a position, to kind of doing it the professional way and to fight for that?
Well, not so much that, but there were always people who supported me along the way. Promoters back in Dresden in East Germany. I worked with a guy, Stefan Glaser, who's still a promoter to this day, who helped me immensely. But also later, when I started releasing music, the people who gave me my first break as a producer and took a risk with an unknown producer and released the record and helped me along the way, that was a guy, Riley Reinhold, who is the owner of Traumschallplatten and Trapez.
Yes, so it was Mutant Pop, right?
Exactly.
To release that one.
Yeah, no, still, to this day, I'm mega grateful for people like that who don't just go for the sure shot, because a lot of labels are kind of risk averse. They want the finished product and they'll only sign hits. And they would rather poach an up and coming artist from a smaller label and put it on their label than to build someone from the ground
up. Completely new, yeah.
Exactly. And I think it's just extremely important to still have people on the scene who take a chance with someone new, because without these people, you'd always only hear the same people and there would never anyone new coming up.
Yes. And do you think today it's worse than when you started, that fact that they're not going to get somebody new, or that it's maybe with the social networks it helped or not? Because some people come out of the blue on Instagram and or YouTube, they just post one song and sometimes it can be great. Or maybe the labels, because there is less money with all the streaming things, they take even less risks. What's your opinion?
Well, I think the game today is so different from what it used to be. Like back in the days, the only way to release music was through a label. Nowadays, you have a lot of people who just released their own music and became superstars. I mean, look at for instance, The Weeknd.
Yes.
I remember when The Weeknd self-released his first album on SoundCloud, and through the quality of the music, he became famous. So the music itself was the viral thing. So I think if you're really super good right now, it is easier to come up. On the other hand, the whole world has access to the same music, which also means you're not only competing locally with other
with your
artists.
Bar, you're competing
exactly.
with the whole...
No, everybody is competing with the whole world. So in order to make it, I think the bar is a lot higher. You have to be really good at something. That something can be, you could be a marketing genius, or you could have an irresistible aura, or you're very beautiful. That's the type I like the best, is the guys and girls who make it through sheer hard work, who just outwork everyone else and then get somewhere. And they take the long route and no shortcuts. And then in the end, the music is just consistently great.
And they have a lasting career.
Yes, because they've spent so much time in the studio perfecting their craft. And Who Made Who is a good example of that. They've been around and they had their ups and downs. And now they're probably at their peak. And someone else I would put into that category is Maceo Plex, who I've seen through the years. I mean, he's a maniac in the studio, spent so much time just making music. And at some point, he just got so good, there was just no way around him. And he had to become famous. And those are the stories that I like to hear, yes.
Yes, and about actually your own story, because you have 20 years of career, like already, and you produced more than 100 edits and remixes, about 30 singles and EPs in total, because you worked also with other artists like Umaytu for Nefertari. And you, though, you said yourself, because you are very honest about that you experienced moments of doubt, reassessment. And how did you manage to make your way, you were talking about like Maceo Plex and Umaytu, out of these difficult times? And to which extent did music act as an antidote for you? Or did you use another antidote, actually, and music was the way out?
I think the difficult times usually come when your ambition is bigger than you are as a person at that moment. And for me, I kind of hit a wall around 2013 when Trout closed the club. I lost my residency and all of a sudden I fell into a hole and I saw other artists who came up with me together, they passed me by and they went to touring the world and nobody wanted anything from me. And I was like, I went through this phase of blaming others. Why them? Why not me? The world isn't fair. And the pivotal shift for me was to have a good look in the mirror and be honest to myself and say, maybe it's my own fault. And yes, it was my own fault. I was lazy. I just lacked discipline and work ethic. I also spent too little thought thinking about other people when I made my art. So I was kind of self-indulgent. It's like, I make the music that I make. And
for yourself.
Yes, and I know best and I have to teach you guys. Once I let go of that and once I really started, okay, I need structure in my life. I need a more clear direction and I need to make music that actually has a market. And once I made that decision and I consciously decided to make music that would be considered like peak time records, records that are really bangers. Once I made that decision and I started making music that really got the hands in the air, all of a sudden the door started opening. So many other DJs started playing my records. It was easier to sign records to labels because
you were open to others and you were not on yourself, basically.
But also, this
is very simple when you explain it.
But also every label loves a hit record.
Yes. You know,
they all love big records. And as an artist, once you make something where there's a good market for it, it's far easier than to work in a niche that interests nobody. So I had to raise the quality and at the same time, I had to understand the world a little bit better and what people actually wanted. And once I made that decision, everything just got better. Of course, then you start having initial success and you start touring the world. Yeah, I also fell into all kinds of traps.
And then comes another phase.
Yeah, because you go out, you play with your heroes and they invite you to the after parties and then you lose yourself in drugs. And I went through that phase as well. And then at some point I hit rock bottom again. I was just, you know, I started to miss my flights, not play well because I was high or drunk. And then again comes the moment where you have to look in the mirror and say to yourself, I have to change something. So I decided I need to clean myself up from the inside. And
that's when you did ayahuasca, right?
Exactly. I heard from a colleague, the girls from Blondish, they gave me the tip of there's this place in the Amazon forest and rainforest in Peru. Try that. So I went onto my first ayahuasca retreat, something that I've been doing regularly ever since. And that was just like rocket fuel. You know, I became a different person. I was always really shy and a closed person. I told myself, oh, I don't like people, which is not a good starting point when you're
for
an entertainer.
Yes.
But the ayahuasca really opened up my heart and let the creativity flow. And I started really enjoying people and being there for people. And my mission also changed to be of service to the people, to become a connector, to bring everyone together. And I think I've been riding that wave ever since.
Yeah, but it's interesting because when you speak about it, it's like you stop being inwards because you have this retreat and kind of cleaning of yourself. And now you can be outwards and just be out there for other people.
I mean,
because your stuff is clean. I mean, you are doing your work and then you can be, it's actually one of my last questions, but now I will take the other one then.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a channel and you can be like really a connector, as you said.
Exactly.
But if you haven't done the work on yourself, you can't be that. So
and the work is difficult. The work is continuous.
Yes.
It is not like you drink
ayahuasca. No, it's a discipline.
Yeah. The ayahuasca makes you see it, but you still have to implement the things in your life. And it's a long process. And I'm still today, when I have a bad gig, I feel physically uncomfortable. And then I avoid eye contact. I hunch behind the decks. My body language doesn't ooze confidence. So I still have bad days, but my bad days are much better than they used to be. So my bottom is much better than back in the days when I could just panic or just give up. And now I never give up. When I'm playing, I play for an hour and I see the dance floor going emptier and emptier, which are the hard gigs. I still try to make connection, even if there's one person on the floor. I try to make a connection with that person and play the best I can to that one person. And more often than not, I've turned a bad night around and turned it into a good night. Because something that's really important, if the last few records of a set are good, people remember the set as a good set.
It's a good one, yes. Yeah. The last 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I heard that already, but I think you all agree,
yeah,
that it's very important to give the last impression must be like...
Yeah, yeah. Just don't give up.
Something positive and just... Yeah.
Exactly. Just got to hammer away and hammer away. And then at the end, maybe there is light at the end of the tunnel and you just come out someplace better, you know?
Yeah, so my introduction was good when you say we go to a labyrinth with you and then at the end there is always the light.
Yeah.
But you know, you never know what's on the way, but yes, in the end there is always the light. I think in your productions it's the same. Like, there is always an opening, there is something going ascendant. It's never, it makes you think, but not in the, like, the downwards way. There's always an upward, like.
For my productions, I had a meeting with a classical composer and he was listening to my stuff and he said, it's not bad, but there's nothing happening. You stay in the same place. And he gave me the best piece of advice. So I still heed that advice whenever I make a record, to imagine a piece of music like a movie. And a movie needs to have a story that goes somewhere and it works its way to a climax, and then the climax comes to a conclusion, and then you have a complete story
and you have
satisfaction. And I try to put that into every song. So I try to not just create a loop and just stay in that loop and there's nothing happening, but there needs to be a dynamic change. There needs to be a journey somewhere, and there needs to be a moment of explosion, of emotional outburst, some sort of, you know, reward moment in the song.
Is it what happened actually with Nefertari that you did with Humaito? Was it a bit of a like dramatic composition? Because they also work that way. Like, did you write a story together? Like, how did it? Because now that like you have 2 million streams on Spotify of that song.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. I mean, your highest one is Roar. Of course, it's 7 million.
Yeah.
But I mean, second is Nefertari, which was in 2021. So it's recent.
Okay, yeah.
And it's kind of a big hit. So how did you, as you were two, I mean, you and Humaito, two, three, four,
yeah,
on that. How did you manage to do that?
It was really casual. Basically, the Humaito guys made a demo with that track, Nefertari. It was still unfinished. It was basically just kind of like parts almost. And they sent me that and I kind of treated it like a remix. So I was like,
Okay.
Yes. So we there was never a moment when we spent time together in the studio.
Okay. That was my question.
But they gave a starting point and, they basically delivered, the musical ideas and I turned it into something that works in a club and on the dance floor, which is actually my strength because.
Yes. That's my next question.
The Who guys, they are real musicians. They play instruments. They know, you know, they know about chord structures, harmonies, etc. And they're like also instinctive performers. And I know the dance floor really well, but when the musical ideas come from someone who's, better at that than I am, then the overall product is going to be better.
It's huge,
that's why I love remixing, because especially, and when I remix, I always try to find raw material that already is really musical, because then I can do something with it. For me,
that was my question. How do you create a good remix? Because you're the top remixer of them all. I mean, you can remix anyone, and I mean, everything is like, you have your touch. I mean, you're here, it's remixed by you,
yeah,
of anyone, but it's always something like, I don't know how to say, you manage to be at the service of the artist and also to put your touch, and it's a perfect balance. It's not any, I mean, no one is upper than the other one. Like, the original, like, work is completely respected, but we know it's you. So that's like really something special.
80% of a good remix is determined by picking the right material, the stuff that fits for me. So for instance, if I often get asked by other techno producers and they have just a normal techno track, something that already sounds like something that I could do myself. And to turn that into a better remix is actually quite difficult because the material is uninspiring to me. It feels too much already what I would do myself. So there is little left for me to improve on. But once you start crossing genres, that's why I also love, for instance, remixes by, like you say, Underworld or Depeche Mode.
Yes.
To do something that comes more from an indie background and turn that into club, then I have added value and I have a lot of material to play with.
Is it what happened with Lana Del Rey's Doing Time, my favorite one?
Yes. Unfortunately, that remix never got an official release. But I listened to the album, and I had my management reach out to Lana's management, and they sent me the parts, and it's like, yeah, here, play with it. It was a joy, because once you hear Lana's voice separate from the background instrumentation or anything, you realize how good of a vocalist she actually is, because her voice is pitch perfect. Her timing is really, really good. Super easy, because often is when you work with vocalists and they're not top class, a lot of the work goes into getting the pitch right, getting the timing right, and you have to manipulate the voice quite a lot.
And not to be in the track itself, you're in the voice. Yeah. That's, yeah.
And with Lana, you just put the voice in, you put a beat underneath it, and it's already start sounding really good, you know? So, yeah. And even though it never got officially released, I just put it out on my SoundCloud, and it found its way into the world, and many people liked that song.
Oh, anyway. Yes.
So it was...
Hopefully, please release it. Yeah. No, but really, it's like, for me, it's one of your, like, you have like done tons of them, but it's so distinct of yours, yeah. And also very different from all other producers who remixed her,
yeah.
Because there were others, but this is like... We know it's you. Exactly what I said.
Exactly. Like, and for me, I rarely use breakbeats, but in this case, I did, because I thought it fit, because of her voice. The original had a certain syncopation that works better with a breakbeat than with a straight beat.
So you were comfortable and you're like, okay, let's just
try
other stuff that
exactly.
Even me, I never do, because I'm so comfortable with the material.
Exactly. Yeah. This is, by the way, something that I always try to do. I never force things in the studio. I don't go into the studio with an idea in my head and I want to do that, but I let the music write itself.
So you call it happy accidents, right?
Happy accidents. Yeah, just basically you go with the flow, whatever the machines present you with. If it's good, you keep building on that. But I try to get out of the way, out of the process, and I try to not use my brain too much.
Yeah.
Because the brain is trained to think in a certain way, and all our brains think in very similar ways. And whenever I try to force something with my own brain, it sounds normal. It sounds pedestrian. But once I invite happiness and a certain free spirit and a sort of laissez-faire attitude into the music, the results are much more surprising.
Yes. Is it the same also with your DJ sets when you like have all-nighters? Like you did one at Shelter Amsterdam,
yeah,
if I'm correct?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a moment where you just drop your brain and you're like, okay, let's just go with the...
Those are the best DJ sets. And the longer the DJ sets, the easier it is to get into...
To drop your brain.
Yeah, to get into a subconscious zone where you start doing things where, like, the next day you listen back to the mix and you think...
Wasn't me.
Yeah, how did we even get here? You know, it's like, you have to kind of tap into the more, like, universal intelligence rather than your own intelligence. And that basically produced from the subconscious. And then the best thing happened.
That's what happened at Shelter, for example.
Yes, it took me 3 hours to get in, but I still had 4 hours to go. So
yeah,
that's
so
fine.
Another problem.
It was 3 hours of hard work, and then all of a sudden it clicked. And then, we had some magic moments.
And you think people hear it when it clicks or not?
I think I hear it more than they do.
But the attitude changes, maybe.
When something extraordinary happens, everybody feels that. Yeah. Absolutely. That's the beautiful thing about music. You don't have to explain people how to listen to music. We all know instinctively, we all understand music as a language.
Universal language.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Apart from music, actually, I know you listen to podcasts and to maybe other things.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to present us with two programs, podcasts, whatever that you love listening to? I think there is one on producing that I listen to, which is very nice.
Yes.
And maybe another one. I don't know.
The one on music that I would recommend is called Tape Notes.
Yes.
And Tape Notes invites musicians and producers to talk about how they produce their latest album. And it's really beautiful to, you're basically being led through all the stages. You listen to the first demos, and then they often share little tricks, how to get into a certain frame of mind, what instruments they use. So basically, it's a view behind the curtain. and they invite people from very varying genres. So you would have someone like Floating Points, more electronic music minded, or John Hopkins. But you'd also have indie bands like Foals,
for instance. London Grammar.
Yeah, London Grammar. So, I think it's better education than paying for a class somewhere and have someone teach you how to use a synthesizer, you know?
Because, says the self-taught man. So,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, you hear it from people who've done it successfully. And that's the stuff you need to learn. Another podcast that I really love is the Lex Friedman Show, which is a talk podcast, a long format talk podcast. And Lex Friedman is a young scientist from MIT, but with a very
open mind
and a broad variation of interests. I would compare it. It's basically, I started listening to these talk podcasts by listening to Joe Rogan.
Yes.
And Lex Friedman is kind of a natural evolution as you know.
Next level.
Yeah, it's the next level up from Joe Rogan. Depending on the guests, you get some amazing guests. For instance, he had a guy on his show who used to work as a Russian spy in America. And he would be telling stories about the spy years, which is fascinating. But there's also a lot of podcasts focused on economy, on politics, on cryptocurrency. I'm really interested in Bitcoin and crypto, because I'm thinking money is the basic operating system that runs everything else. So everything else is downstream from the monetary system. And all the problems that we encounter today, whether it's economical inequalities or environmental problems, they actually stem from an imperfect monetary system. And for me, Bitcoin is a way to leave this corrupt system and to be able to have my money, have full control over it. Because if you look at, for instance, what happened to Malta, to Greece, all of a sudden people couldn't access their bank accounts anymore. We're only allowed to take 50 euros a day out of their bank account. Now with Bitcoin, I have full control across borders. I can take, if shit hits the fan, I hope it doesn't, but if it does, I can take it with me wherever I go. So yeah, to understand, and I used to be really into crypto, but the longer I'm into this, the more the answer for me is not crypto, but it's Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is the only truly decentralized, truly independent cryptocurrency out there.
It's kind of a new dollar, but of a new world. I mean, the dollar used to be that in the 19th century, according to me. But it was the reference of a new world. Nobody knew what was going to happen, but you could trust it.
The moment the dollar went off the gold standard,
yes,
which was in 71, that basically it turned into what crypto heads would consider a shit coin, because all of a sudden the money printing can happen in a very uncontrolled way, because you no longer need to hold.
You don't have the gold.
You need the gold reference. You need the equivalent in gold in your bank account, and all of a sudden that connection between the physical reality that forces you to work for your money before you can earn it went away, and the people in charge of the printing press all of a sudden had free reign.
Hello, let's go. With Bitcoin, I think it's hopeful that we can stay at that stage, that you have a reliance. But it's not the same reliance we used to have. It's not the same system. It's reliant in something that is not going to lose itself.
Bitcoin is the hardest money that has ever existed. Because even in gold is inflationary as well, because there's constantly being...
But at the time, there was more than that.
Yes.
I mean, couldn't do more than gold.
Gold was the best possible money out there for many centuries. That's why it's been used as money for 5,000 years. But now with Bitcoin, you have a money that you can really not print any more of. At the same time, you can send a billion across the world to someone else It costs you pennies. And this also opens up a true world economy. You can interact economically with someone in Africa. And now that remote working becomes a reality, the planet is the marketplace and the planet is the workplace. So Bitcoin is truly global money, and it also diminishes the importance of the nation state.
Yes.
Because it operates across borders.
Within people and not within borders of states.
Exactly. And I see Bitcoin as the truth engine, the one thing that cannot be manipulated. So it forces everybody participating in that system to be truthful in some way.
So the message was passed and we had like a very nice financial 101.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Speaking of message, you have one message to convey with your own project now. You have your Halo project.
Yes.
So if I understood correctly, it's a tour project because it's a tour format. It's like the way you like to play a set. So it's different organization that you used to have and you got acquainted with your, like the people or the places you love playing at.
Yes.
And you just organized a new concept. And there is also a record label going with it, or?
Yes. This is,
can you just unroll it for me a little bit?
The record label right now,
you don't have time if you tour to do it. So.
Yeah, and I'm really casual about it. That's not the important part. The important part are the parties. The idea behind Halo was is I've already toured the world several times, played wherever I wanted to play, and I needed something new to motivate myself. And to do the same thing again and again, hopefully for a little bit more money, just isn't enough. So I wanted to create an environment where I had full control over the music from start to finish. And with Halo, that is the case. And I want to take Halo as a project to my favorite clubs throughout the world and present it there and then play all night long. And then basically deliver something that is a bit more profound, a bit more deeper and a bit more me. Because many of the sets that we get to play nowadays are an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then you just blow through the biggest records and that's it.
Yeah, and you don't have the spiritual experience you were describing earlier. For example, at Shelter, where you had this 3 hours and then like the four next hours were something completely different. And you don't have the space to express yourself the way you want.
Exactly.
You'd like to.
And when you play a long set, you're forced to go beyond the usual.
And you push your boundaries.
Yeah, because at some point, you know your records well, you know what works, you play your hits and then you run out of the hits. And you still have half the night to go. What do you do now? Then you have to go deep. You play your B-sides. You play stuff that you haven't played in years, maybe never. And you just discover something new. So it also helps me to become a much better DJ. And also to remove the insecurity of having someone unknown play before you, someone that you're not musically familiar with, who might set a completely different vibe than what you, different mood than what you would prefer. To remove that and have full control on how you build the dance floor. So, for instance, to make sure that people don't tire out too quickly, that they don't peak too soon, but that you really gently, gently lift them on the level and then you brood, and then 4 hours in, then you let it explode for the first time. It's just, it's more intense.
So you write your own story from beginning to end,
yes.
As the composer says.
Yeah.
It's like you're your own writer.
Yeah.
And it's kind of your play or your story.
Yeah.
No, that's great. And I read somewhere, but maybe it's not true, that you're starring in Netflix series as well. Is that released? Because I saw it on Netflix like in March, that there was something about DJ somewhere.
Yes.
And then nothing. And I was like,
there is it's an ongoing project. We just started filming last week.
Okay.
You never know if it ever sees the light of day. I hope so. But the concept is to create a series of episodes. Each episode features one artist. Other artists like Monica Cruz are there, Dixon, Pig and Dan, Luca Bacchetti. So not only big hitters, but just, it's more about humans. It's not about depicting the road to success and then how you made it into superstar, because that, at the end of the day, what you want is something where people get motivation out of, that aspiring artists feel encouraged to start on their own journey and do it in a way that is also systematic, where you learn from others. Okay, this is what helped that person to get to a certain place. Maybe I can take something on board for myself. So yeah, and my episode, we started filming last week during ADE. We had the first interviews. The episodes are going to be 45 minutes to an hour. So they require a lot more filming than that. I think we're going to film at least 3 or 4 more sessions.
Dates, yes, of yours, and go around.
On the road, in the studio, at home. So we'll try to deliver something profound here.
Great.
I have no idea what the release schedules are on Netflix. And the world changes so quickly. It's like, it's so unpredictable, but
it started filming. It's already there.
Exactly.
Somewhere.
Exactly. Exactly. It's starting to get real now. Yes.
Oh, talking about playlists, and I just would like you to know that we have a playlist going with each episode. Mm-hmm. I know you have several of yours on Spotify and, you know, so, or a set maybe that you would like to recommend to us that is actually your identity card of the moment that mm-hmm. you would like to share, because I know your sets are on SoundCloud as well.
Yeah.
So you can like share with us. I can put the link to it on the notes. Which set or which playlist would you say fits with Here and Now that you just would like to share?
I think the Electronic Groove, the 900th episode that I made, is probably a really good representation. It's a live recording from Fusion Festival.
Yes, of course.
So it's not something that happened in the studio, but it happened with a crowd around and in real life and with all its flaws.
Was it the last Fusion, like this year? Or
This year, yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Jade was there too, and she also recommended her Fusion set.
Ah, yeah.
So okay. That edition of Fusion must have been like...
Every Fusion is a special festival. It's a top three festival in the world. It's difficult to describe because it's, in terms of people, there's true diversity. There's not only white and black and gay and transgender, etc. No, there's also poor people, ugly people, old people. And it doesn't matter. Everybody is one big family, but it's a true representation of society. And the ethos behind Fusion Festival is really interesting. From a left-wing anarchist background. So they pay really a lot of attention to creating a festival that is fair. They don't pay the huge fees to the artists because they feel that's unjust to everyone else who works their asses off there. So people play for next to nothing or nothing at all, Fusion. They don't have advertising on site. So they try to counter the commercialism that you find at so many bigger festivals nowadays.
They go by word of mouth, yeah. By just...
No advertising. They only use small vendors. There's no meat. It's all over. It's like organic food. It's all, you know, the food, the drinks, everything is done with love. The musical selection is quite big. You have everything from hardcore dungeon to rap to techno. And they pay really good attention to sound. Some of the sound systems at Fusion are just unbelievable. And the stage that I played at was called Bachstelzen, which is a stage that is being programmed by the Carter Blau crew in Berlin. And these guys are like family. So
You were at home and you were like experiencing and just like, also, as you said, maybe it was an experience where you had like the room to just express yourself and lead your story where you want.
Yeah, exactly.
To go. Yeah. Great. So I'll put the link in the notes of the episode. Perfect. Last question, mm-hmm. bonus track, but I think we went pretty much through the two of them, but you're going to choose to go a bit deeper into one of these two options. You said in an interview that art should be used as a weapon of change. What changes are you aiming at? But you pretty much said that about Bitcoin already. I mean, about your vision of society and everything. But there is option two. Then you can choose, maybe.
I think that...
this one?
No, yeah, that's a good question, yes.
Okay, let's take this one.
The change that I want to see, especially being done through music, is that we find together again. Because we're a social species, and we're not a species that thrives behind screens and at home and remote meetings, etc. There needs to be a moment in our lives when we find together and when we, regardless of background, see each other as brothers and sisters, and we love and respect each other, and we celebrate our differences together on the dance floor. Just basically leave all the political bullshit behind and just be there as people and just also feel the power that we have when we stick together. Because when we're separated from each other in our living rooms, just on social media, all we feel is we feel alone and we feel this need to be recognized.
Yes.
And the only way to have that need fulfilled is we get FaceTime with each other. Exactly. Yes. And that, I think, is the power of music. Music transcends politics by a huge margin. I think music is a much more powerful tool than politics to change the world.
Yes, and I think it's much better to make music than war. So
For sure.
I'd say that as a conclusion. Thank you so much, Patrice, for being on the mic with us for Track Record episode 11.
All right. Thank you.
We wish you the best for tonight, mm-hmm. for Thanks. Your upcoming Hello Tour. And we hope to hearing more of you very soon.
You will. Thank you.
Thank you.
On dit parfois que l'électro est froide, sans âme, car composée avec des machines. J'espère que ce podcast vous a prouvé le contraire, car il me semble qu'il faut encore plus d'humanité pour produire une musique de ce type, qui puisse rassembler autant de gens dans une communion et un engouement qu'on voit rarement ailleurs aujourd'hui. Si vous voulez soutenir Track Record, n'hésitez pas à partager ce podcast et à nous laisser vos commentaires sur votre plateforme d'écoute préférée. Merci à toutes et à tous pour votre écoute et à très vite pour un nouveau Track Record.